Start of interview with Colvin R. De Silva, 23rd of June, 1967.
No, for instance, I was wondering what led you to take interest in politics in general and in Marxist politics in particular.
I think politics is in the air and in the atmosphere in the time when you grew up. There was hardly a fellow coming out of the university anyway, even in Ceylon at the time, who had some interest in politics.
Did they?
And I should say I got it out of a social concern. The question of you know, people having a square deal, whether individually or collectively, has always been important to me, even as a young fellow in school. And it is a natural development in our time that one should go get drawn into the political movement, because after all, the first question of a square deal, freedom, etc., is the freedom of your own country, isn't it? So that leads you on to other things. From the question of the freedom of your country, which is a question of the anti-imperialist issue, to the question of how imperialism operates in your country, then the question of social justice within the society in your own country, which is surely not limited by merely the question of imperialist subjection, but has the whole question of what is the source of poverty in the country and so on. But all that leads you to quite a way to go along. For myself, I came to Marxism slowly and frankly as I mature. I suppose radical by temperament, but I moved in terms of radicalism, what you would nowadays say, steadily leftward, until I came to Marxist literature actually after I had returned from England. I'm not one of those people who adopted Marxism while a student in England, sometimes in a rather callow way. Those were the days when the Stalinist version of official Marxism was the dominant thing in the world. I didn't fall under its influence directly. I came to Marxism even after I had done a certain amount of political work here. And frankly, when I got to the Marxist literature, I found that somehow everything clicked into place. And I felt I had at last got to the theory which gives me the key and the handle to understand the thing.
Then, in that case, the stress which people lay on Harold Laski's influence didn't operate in your case?
No, I'm not a London School of Economics man like so many of my colleagues. I come, curiously enough, from a very Christian and almost churchy college, King's College London, which has a very strong theological faculty. That's where I am. In London University, I was throughout and things right to the end.
No, I
read Laski. But he wasn't that powerful influence on me. And I'm quite sure that as I matured, Laski would have left me unsatisfied. Or put it the other way, yes, he would not have satisfied me.
Any particular books on Marxism which influenced your progress?
I have fortunately been a direct reader of Marx and so on and others, instead of reading about them, of them, or commentary about them. I'm for quite a time, and I wouldn't be surprised if it is true even today, I am probably one of the few people in Ceylon who has read all three volumes of Marx's Capital. But of course I did that when I had the leisure in jail. The leisure to read and the leisure to think over it, you know, to analyze, summarize. It is one of my permanent regrets. I summarized Marx down to what I will call the skeleton of his Capital in his own phraseology. And I'm sure if that had been kept by me and published, it had become quite a useful work internationally. But I had to pass it out when I was running a vehicle in jail, and those papers all
They lost.
I had a lot of very valuable papers. They were all lost.
I like the introduction in your book on Ceylon under the British occupation when you thank them for...
I suppose I couldn't resist, you know, a little fun. That was a very useful time, you know.
What about Trotsky's writing?
You see, I suppose there is one book, a basic book of Trotsky's, that was the decisive influence on all those who took to the Trotskyist view of what was happening in the world revolutionary Marxist movement, that is the revolution of the trade. When Mr. Leslie Gunawardena went abroad in the middle 30s, he brought back a copy of the book, probably one of the first copies that was out. And undoubtedly that book influenced the whole group of us very strongly. And maybe it was decisive in crystallizing our ideas away from the Stalinist program. In truth, you know, those who ultimately took the Trotsky's plan had before, I think they were referring to the Trotsky's writings, been already, shall we say, unhappy about the Stalinist line, especially on the colonial revolution. Our feeling and opinion was, and I think now history has justified it, that he was seeking to utilize the colonial movement and the world revolutionary movement for the narrow interests of Soviet foreign policy. We never gave way on those things.
Hello?
We were a group that Hello? Had never been, for instance, in the Comintern.
Hello?
And so when the issue arose more sharply in relation to the line that was being followed by the Soviet Union in relation to what was then the coming war, World War II, we were able to look at the question without previous commitments in any direction. I mean by that, those of us who took the Trotsky's line, the main leadership of those who took the Stalinist line undoubtedly were linked up with the Comintern and with the Communist Party of Britain in particular.
How had they been linked up? In what way?
Well, in the first place, Dr. Vikramasinghe was in England for many years. After he was defeated in the 1935-36 general election, admittedly, he was a leader of the Samaj Samajwadi Party. But naturally, I mean, inevitably, his affiliations, associations, and his tendency would gather a strong following within the party. Secondly, he had this Grace girl, whom we ourselves brought into the party. And this girl was a committed communist youth leader, and that he systematically developed a group here around that program, we knew. What did I tell you? I've forgotten.
Speaking
about Grace Gerner, So ultimately, Bresner built a group here. We know that. We didn't stand in the way because in the party we have not objected to people holding various lines of tendencies, especially in the pre-war days when we were a very loose party. Then, of course, we had a chap who is now in Jaffna. What is his name?
Karachi?
No. A man from Cambridge, Karachi, who returned to Ceylon just before the war, a committed Stalinist. What is his name on the ticket?
Kandai?
The White Linger man. A very highly educated, very able chap.
He wrote some pamphlet, didn't he, later on?
Yes. He was a virulent chap, you see. Well, he took a strong part in strengthening the tendency. All these people together, built up the Stalinist wing. Then, of course, the war came. And in relation to the war, it was absolutely essential that we should finally decide on which line we were taking, because they led to two different courses of activity which demanded altogether different lines of organization, etc. Also, as you no doubt know, the pre-war LSSP was a broad, loose organization in which really it was open to all socialist tendencies and not even only revolutionary tendencies to operate. It was not as a party committed to any specific ideology. Still that by constitution it was committed to complete independence, the removal of social discriminations and socialism. But of course by this time it had become pretty clear that the leadership of the party was in the hands of people who were themselves strongly organized. Myself was part of the Sikh organization. So were we all. And of course within that organization, to which we thought originally to keep the issue, we who held Trotsky's village, for instance, we were not trying to force our views on the party or to precipitate the issue in the party. But there is no doubt that the Stalinist wing adopted the wing forward and aggressive policy on the issue. Then, well, it had to be fought out, and it had to be fought out in the open, and it was fought out in the open.
That is at the annual congress?
It went ultimately to the annual conference, having first been fought out, you know, generally in the party and in the central committee and so on. The whole thing ultimately crystallized out on the question of the nature of the war. You see, you will recollect, really I think it would be very hard to find a man, even who was then of the Stalinist persuasion, who will, shall we say, unreservedly defend the line of activity that was taken then by the Comintern and the Soviet Union. Anyhow, the essential thing was this. When Stalin swung his policy sharp round, his foreign policy sharp round, and turned from what had been an appeal consistently made for a period of about 9-10 years for an alliance with what he called the democratic imperialism, that is to say with the Anglo-French-American imperialism, and turned to an alliance with Hitler, and through Hitler, with the fascists. Well, by sheer bureaucratic orders from on top, he lined up the whole of the Comintern. We, of course, were in the first place not members of the Comintern and had no particular association. We had always been an independent party, and I think that's the important fact rooted in this country, though working on the Marxist ideology, which I don't regard as a foreign ideology any more than I regard Buddhism as a foreign ideology. When the World War started with the attack on Poland by the German forces, Stalin took the position that really Hitler was on the defensive, and that the imperialists who refused to recognize the partition of Poland were the aggressors. Of course, from our point of view, which is practical on the international class struggle, it was not a question of one or other being the aggressors against the other, both being aggressors upon the peoples. But that's by the way. So that, in fact, after a short period, during which the Comintern itself was internationally in utter confusion, you see. Now, for instance, the British Communist Party thought this was the classical war they had been prepared for, to fight against Hitler and the fascist forces on the side of British imperialism on the basis of the anti-fascist issue and the popular front and so on. They were brought to heel in 6 weeks. This happened in this way. We, of course, took the position very simply that that was a straight imperialist war. And it being an imperialist war on both sides, as far as we were concerned, our task was to continue the class struggle and the revolutionary struggle and so on, which meant being in opposition to the war and carrying on the class struggle regardless of the consequences to the imperialists and their war.
How many were expelled from the party here?
I forget the figures, but I would say this. It was a minority that was expelled, and the expulsions were also only of the leadership of the minority. It was not sought to kind of, you know, carry it right through or that, but to act in respect of the leading group, which had to be expelled. There was no possibility.
How many in the Central Committee? Roughly?
I've forgotten. But I shall be surprised. The division was very far different from two-thirds to one-third, meaning their wing was small.
In fact, I was under the impression that it was even less than one-third.
I merely said it probably was, yes. But I can't remember, so don't take it from me. You should ask somebody like Oreste. He will remember a thing like that. It's probably even less. But what I'm trying to say is it was certainly not more than one-third. You see, there was another thing. By this time, we knew that our legal period was over. It was not going to be long before the government moved in against us, because we accorded our activity to the word. Because, that is to say, when for the first time in Ceylon, in the plantation history, a major strike wave started out in the plantation, provided the leadership for it and carried it through very, very militantly. Says he wasn't there then. It had just been formed, I think, that the leadership of that strike, major strike wave, you see, I myself, who took the first step that brought us right in, I happened to be in Kandy at the office of the Estate Workers Union, which we controlled or which we led or ran, when the news of the strike at Mulwar, which is further north from Kandy, came to Kandy and was brought to our office. It is I who actually took the necessary steps to provide the leadership for that strike. And of course that went from one to the other, right across to it. And then they gave us the waiver.
What
Nova.
Exactly was the cause or causes?
In Mulaya,
mm-hmm.
if my memory is correct, it's a strange, my memory is not very good on the matter, but I took so prominent a part that it was I who really conducted the, ultimately the legal side in respect to the commission of inquiry that looked into the shooting of Govind, and we did successfully. The commissioner held that it was an unjustifiable shooting. I think it was wages plus dismissal, but really, it was a unionization issue.
Wages plus dismissal, but?
Really, it was a unionization issue.
They wanted the right to have a union?
Yes, and the management had interfered to prevent unionization by victimization.
What union did they want to go into, yours or the Indian one, the Ceylon Indian?
They wanted to form a union in the first place. You know, I speak from memory, which is rather dim. I don't keep these things in my head. But that's something which could easily be found by any researcher, because there is the report of Mr. C. Kumar Sami, district judge at the time, who was the Mulaya commissioner, and who made a very valuable report. I was in jail when the report came out. So, you know that setting. Well, to keep to the other matter first, I'll come to that. Well, let's deal with that. You see, trouble had to come on the plantation by this time. Several streams of occurrences and thoughts came together at this time. In the first place, the Indian estate worker himself was a wielder of the universal adult franchise. Since 1931, he's a man who had shown from the beginning that he was not going to easily bow down to the superintendent politically. He supported Natesa Atta, for instance, during the state council. So, by the late 30s, he twice exercised the vote and thus had become politicalized to that extent. In the course of such politicalization, of course, he got drawn for the first time into, even partially into, the general stream of the political life of the country. You know, our estate worker has always been a completely isolated
block.
Deliberately held separate almost, and certainly held separate by geographical and other conditions from the rest of the country, and with a link by reason of the continual renewal through the stream of immigrants and the movement to and fro with South India, he was kept linked straight in that direction. So you have the second thing, which is very little realized, that in the middle 30s, partly as a result of the pressure of the left forces in the country, partly as a result of a political situation in India itself, the flow of immigrants into Ceylon, fresh immigrants, was stopped. Thus, the estate labor force, or its composition, became reasonably stabilized. It wasn't renewing itself. It was growing within its confines. And so, of course, it had to turn to some kind of action. Then, thirdly, of course, Nehru came here in 1939 and did us a very grave disservice by advising the forming of the Ceylon Indian Congress.
But hadn't Natesa Iyer already formed his group?
Yes, but Natesa Iyer never pulled the Indians together as a community in the manner that the Ceylon Indian Congress did after it was formed by the advice of Nehru, combining the commercial capitalists of Colombo, with the estate worker up there. I mean, it was a pulling together of a community on the basis of it being a community.
How do you square this advice Nehru gave, which is so-called socialism?
I don't square it. I just don't square it. Of course, Nehru is not strictly a socialist. Nehru himself liked to say he was socialistic. And I think he meant the distinction. You know, Nehru is a socialist in the sense that in the 30s and even today, anyone who is endeavoring to be truly progressive has to express himself to some degree in socialist terms. I don't think there was very much more than that. I knew Nehru quite a bit. Quite apart from reading what he said. So, you know, this type wave was bound to come. It is just an accident that it coincided with the war, and that itself is the proof how little the people of Ceylon and the estate workers felt themselves identified with the war and the war situation. It's as if it was irrelevant to their thought. What was most marked was that when they did go into action, they proved to be the most militant, most violent section of the workers in Ceylon. They stood up and fought the bullies. I never forget that crowd. They have a special place, as far as I'm concerned, in my mind.
What sort of success did the wave of strikes have?
I think, had we not been legalized at that time, it would have led to important wage increases in order to keep them quiet during the war. But of course, we were abstracted from the field. They turned to the reformist leadership of the CIC during that period, and the CIC cooperated in the war and really established themselves as a trade union with the regular relations with the employers, and while very strong on subjects like dismissal and that kind of thing, rarely showed themselves deeply concerned with the wage question.
With the?
Wage question. It is amazing, you know, so powerful a union as the estate workers created never really got them any important wage. Never in history.
No wage increases at all.
None worth the talking of in relation to their strength and the situation and the strategic nature and vital nature of the industry in which they work.
How would you explain this? Complacency among the leaders?
The leaders were reformists and primarily were utilizing the workers for certain political objectives of their own. And really entered into unionism as a sideline, although that developed into the strongest aspect of their work in due course. There has been some evolution in that also, in that the younger men like Tondamal and so on, Aziz and Co, ultimately, aggressive union types in their time, replaced the Colombo commercial type of leadership, actually representing a combination within themselves. Tondamal in source of data, well, I mean, belongs very much more to the capitalist class than I do. So does Ali. Many factors come in there. But I don't think the leadership had the deep going interest in the fight for the wage conditions which would affect the general situation for the capitalist class as a whole. That a union like that under a different leadership might have shown.
From your point of view, both with regard to the plantation worker and your other union, wasn't the opposition to the war a tactical setback?
To the unions, yes. What do you mean by tactical?
In the sense that where you lost control of the estate workers and also some unions in Colombo.
Yes, the Stalinist union position really developed during the war. In other words, you are really saying this. If we cooperated in the war, we could have been the sole so-called left movement in the country. I don't know whether it had been worth the fight.
That's the problem.
I don't think so. You see, that's what I was, to get back to our original discussion, by the beginning of 1940, we had had to make very important decisions. With this clarification of the political line, that we were in opposition to the war, and that we would conduct the struggle against the war and the general class struggle in the country, regardless of the consequences to the war of the imperialists, we would be legalized. We had therefore to hasten the reorganization of the party as a fighting unit, which could even act illegally. In other words, we had to Bolshevize the party. And this fight politically was part of the fight, the ideological arming of the party for illegal conditions, while on the other hand, organization of the party was narrowed down, made into a cadre party, and transformed into a machine that could function illegally. As a militant organization with men committed to the facing up to all consequences in order to carry forward the work of the party.
Did the British government and the local authorities have any idea that there was a secret wing?
It was little known inside the party itself.
So some of the open members even, I was wondering how far people like Peter Kennerman and Dr. S. A. Vikramasinghe would have suspected it from their...
Dr. S. A. Vikramasinghe was in the inner organization.
Till 1940?
Till 1940 or the late 30s, Peter Kennerman wasn't in the movement.
Yes.
He was a younger fellow. I knew of him. I had never met him before. And he went abroad to Cambridge, you see. He is really a post-war.
No, I was wondering whether, since they were cooperating with the government, their especially the Dr. S.A.'s previous information wouldn't have been of some use to the government.
Well, I'd rather not think so, exactly. You see, it was known that there was an inner organization, was known, even to those who stood away, because some of those who were in the inner organization. When the inner organization was first formed and functioned for many years, it was not in any manner an organization committed to Trotskyism, nor was it an organization to be brought into which you had to be committed to Trotskyism. The committal to Trotskyism was the result of deliberate decision many years after it came to Trotskyism.
Is it true that the idea of forming a broad socialist or even a Marxist party had taken root in London originally?
Yes. You see, many of the chaps who had studied in London had come together there under the influence of the general Marxist movement in the world and formed a group there, which when it came here found itself naturally forming this broad party.
Who were the members of the inner group here in the 30s?
I am very old-fashioned, you know. I do not even today give out any of that kind of thing, for this reason, but we don't know the future. You must ask me that. Much of it is known, but I don't mind you getting to know it from others.
That means that there were some members who have really dropped out of politics now.
Also, yes. Mm-hmm. Also, yes. What is important is that it is a Marxist grouping committed to the Marxist position, but not committed to one or other school of Marxism. It is only as time went on and the functioning of an inner organization is almost impossible on the basis of unduly prolonged factional activity. Somebody has got to prevail and a discipline has to take place. So you can't imagine us functioning as an illegal organization during the war. Mm-hmm. If we were to have so fundamental a political faction fight as whether we should be opposed to the war or not. I mean, if you are doubtful whether you should be opposed to the war, you can't work illegally.
Were you very careful about taking new members into the inner group? Did you?
Recruitment to the inner group, you can very well say that, you know. It was always the outcome of a unanimous decision. If anybody opposed, then we wouldn't take him out.
Did you put him to some sort of minor test work?
No, we generally knew the people. You see, it could come, arise out of our knowledge of him in the movement itself. That was the whole party functioning. There was also the need of testing people. From when the war was approaching, you had to keep people, certain people, away from being known outside, because you would have no apparatus otherwise. Somewhere, some of our most sterling people were kept out in the late 30s. And proved to be very sterling people.
In the war, yeah. Is it true that the open wing collapsed in the war years?
In what sense?
Where you find it difficult to...
You couldn't carry out LSSP's open political work when the LSSP had been illegal. It had to be illegal work. We had to find ways of getting to open types of activity. The unions and this and that, for chaps function in the unions pretty well.
Now, I was wondering whether under pressure some people just drifted away.
That always happens, no? But it's a singular thing. Such times of stress produce people whom you don't get in ordinary times. It works both ways.
What about the problem of finance? I presume you had it since you didn't have outside connections.
Yes, we had that. Got set out somehow. I am not aware in the illegal period of any major activity that we wanted to conduct that was prevented by financial pressure. Very self-satisfied.
Purely from private sources. No, I've heard story.
Daddy, Daddy,
you have to give me more money today.
How much do you want?
Give me at least 100.
I have left the purse with Anuma. I'll give you another 100 rupees.
100 rupees altogether would do.
Is that so?
In less might do, I don't know. I have two of these.
100 rupees.
That's 30 rupees. I don't want to.
Doesn't matter, Anuma.
Okay. I might not come back tonight, Mom. Right? Somewhere between 3 and 4. Somewhere between 3 and 4. Surely you are coming back. Then don't worry. You needn't leave anything for me now. What did you ask me to do about the bank, isn't it?
Yes, I asked that it was largely private.
This is we found our own. We did even more. We provided considerable financial subvention for the launching of the Trotsky's tendency as an organized tendency in India.
Oh, you even...
We did, I say, very period, please. The war period.
Is that the tape recorder?
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Roberts and I are having a talk about things which he wants recorded.
Yes, sir. He also has tape record, he's lost, but I think that's a part of his
lecture.
Yes, sir. I'll let the tape record. Yeah, I really have a tape recorder. I don't know who listened to it.
Someone mentioned a trip by Vernon Grosecker to London when he was secretary. I was wondering whether that was...
That was before the war.
I was wondering whether he was seeking some sources of financial help.
No, he was sending essentially there as part of his political development as much as anything else.
What about this? The composition of the party, from what strata, in the 30s, from what strata were you drawing the majority of your members?
It was not predominantly working class in origin, although completely working class in India. You know, in the situation in the 30s, you were about to draw in a large middle class element, which was revolutionary minded, and it was all drawn towards the elites. And it was all drawn towards the elites. So I would say the middle class elements were the major section. There was a strong working class section. And there was a group which is bourgeois money, or this upper petty bourgeois.
Looking back over 20, 30 years, some people have criticized the LSSP for being too bourgeois in attitude, and they say that the Central Committee doesn't have enough working class representation.
A political party must have people capable of the political leadership of the movement, not having the right class origin. It's no use being a worker if you are not capable of leading. It's no use being a bourgeois. The point of the matter is elsewhere. Those of bourgeois origin, the question was whether politically they had effectively declassed themselves. And I'm not aware of anyone who came from bourgeois or upper petty bourgeois strata who ever tried to pull the party away from the working class revolutionary line by reason of his class. I honestly am not aware of anyone.
You spoke of declassing yourself, thinking in personal terms, in your own experience. Didn't you find problems in doing so?
I am myself not bourgeois by origin, but that matters not. If you are born into a certain class or a certain region, then at some time or other, political activity, political commitment, which is directly hostile to the system, must result in certain personal problems. As it is, I mean, to myself, whole classes of professional life, as the foreboding. I don't think this has appeared suddenly to me as a matter of any importance.
You said you were not bourgeois in origin. What strata would you say you
are? I put myself in the upper category.
Upper section.
Put it the other way around. My father grew into a wealthy man and came into, undoubtedly, the land-owning bourgeois stratum. In my own lifetime, I witnessed his improvement. in position, economic position, etc., etc. That was one of the beneficiaries thereof as we went along.
What were his chief avenues, just historically speaking? Money or cash crop?
No,
cash crop.
Nobody became bourgeois and philanthropist, Paddy. I know one or two people who tried to shift on to Paddy, being bourgeois, and probably lost their economic position. So that's not a paying crop at that time. It's only after the guaranteed purchase scheme that Paddy has become today probably about the most profitable crop given irrigation.
So what was your home background? Was it urban or rural?
I come from rural background. But of course, as a